Hello, and welcome back to another episode of And the Winner Is. And this time around, we are going to be looking at the 1932 film Grand Hotel, which was MGM. And I think, joining us always by my co-host Paul. Paul, this is one of the first MGMs we've done in a while, isn't it?
Yeah, well, both this month were.
Of course, yes, because yes, I stand corrected. That's the other strange thing about these two. We had two back-to-back MGMs. I totally forgot the other one
And
then.
as you say, 21 years between the two of them,
Yeah,
and there's
two
actually
MGMs,
a
20 years apart, and the same art director.
there's definitely some tying up between these two.
Yeah, and incidentally, because I'll mention it in the facts, where the other one was a musical, this is one for me that I felt should have been a musical, and it turns out it became one later on.
There's definitely, at times it feels like a satirical comedy, which always lends itself to a musical situation.
As always, we'll just jump in with one or two bits and pieces. Now, the budget on this apparently was $750,000. And what sort of box office do you think it did?
Oh, I reckon it was probably about 4 million.
Apparently, 2.5 million. But
Didn't
which is
make my.
probably doesn't sound a lot, but it's probably quite a chunk of change in 1932.
If you did it for inflation, you'd probably find that that's quite a big profit.
So one or two bits and pieces about the film. So apparently MGM remade it themselves in 1945 as Weekend at the Waldorf. And it got a German remake in 1959 called Mention im Hotel. And apparently that served as the basis for the 1989 Tony Award-winning stage musical. So Grand Hotel. So they all the very incestuous relationship with all these different versions. Apparently, in 77, MGM had announced a musical remake, which was going to be set in the Las Vegas Grand Hotel. Incidentally, the MGM Grand Hotel, that's convenient. And directed by Norman Jewison, but it got cancelled in the end. I think there were issues in sort of the development stage, and it never got off the ground. So we could have had a second version of this in the 70s. Which, yeah, I could understand why they want to go and do it as a musical. Like you say, that there are bits and pieces that lend themselves to being a musical. I'm just
Definitely.
having to hear it in a minute. Hang on a minute. There we go. This the joys of recording these things live.
We don't do any planning other than watching
No, that requires to be utterly professional.
And to be honest, I've said this with some of the other shows. I always feel it works better when you don't plan. So
So amongst the amazing cast, of course, we had John Barrymore. And apparently he was so thrilled at the prospect of appearing in the film with Greta Garbo that he accepted the free picture deal with MGM there and then. Boom, that's the way to negotiate. You'll get something you like in the film, and then you can sign on the dotted line. And apparently also Joan Crawford was awestruck by Greta Garbo. They had no scenes together, but Crawford would greet the star with reverence between whenever they passed each other doing setups. But apparently Garbo never responded, so Crawford eventually stopped her efforts to engage her. And apparently one day Garbo stopped Crawford as she walked silently past her, remarking, "Aren't you going to say anything to me?" So that's a very, very strange relationship.
And that never plays well, does it, for a film when there's
No.
absolutely no chemistry? And as you say, they didn't have any scenes together, but I'm sure it doesn't help the rest of the cast.
And this one did tickle me as well. At one point, Oscar winner Wallace Beery, I think he won an Oscar that year for something else. He stormed out of rehearsal saying he would only come back when Joan Crawford learns to act.
Oh dear.
That's harsh. And she was no slouch, Joan Crawford, in her career, let's be honest.
No.
Oh, she was talking of Joan Crawford again as well. Apparently, she initially objected to her role as Flemington, or Flem, as she calls herself, because she feared that too much of her performance would be censored for being provocative and racy. And that is actually a good point, because it is a rarely interesting performance that we'll chat about in a minute. And apparently, this was the only Best Picture Oscar not to be nominated for any other Academy Awards. And it was one of the only three movies to win the Best Picture without winning any others. And the others we've already done, Broadway Melody and Mutiny on the Bounty. So I love how we got these little quirks across the Academy years of some films just getting like a, getting like, almost like a token nomination and yet still winning with it.
Yeah, very strange.
And we discussed in the last one where sometimes some of them get completely overlooked in the acting awards.
Yeah.
And this one's got quite a chunky cast from the time. And yet none of them were sort of deemed worthy of an acting nomination. At that point, I suppose we'll just jump into the film. Although I was going to mention, did I mention that we are, it was up against, no, we haven't, have we?
No, and I didn't on the last one either. I completely forgot.
Let's have a look. Where do we, I did have it written down. Here we go. Yes, it was up against a film called Aerosmith, Bad Girl, The Cham, Five Star Final, 1 Hour With You, Shanghai Express, and The Smiling Lieutenant in outstanding production. I have to say, I don't think I've seen any of those nominations, and I don't think I've heard of most of them.
This is no, good. I hadn't. I think possibly that I'd heard of the last one.
Other than The Champ. I know because The Champ got remade with John Boyd in later years. So there's definitely gaps in some of our 30s knowledge outside of Universal Monsters.
yeah, very much so. And and this is the whole reason why we decided to do this show.
Yeah.
Was to go back and watch some of those films that we probably wouldn't have watched.
Yeah. And that's a whole other debate about how some of those films never got anywhere near Oscar.
Yeah.
There is always, despite being actual classics of the genre. Anyway, so we'll jump into some bits about the film. I mean, this is one I think you probably watched. I rented it on Amazon Prime, so it's available on Prime and one of the other places. Yeah. Print isn't great. There's a lot of hissing in it, I must admit.
Yeah, and it was very jumpy in colour.
Mm.
It'd go from like a close up shot and it'd be in one hue and then it'd jump to a wide shot and it's a completely different colour.
Yeah. The one that I did gleam out the opening, which was quite nice, was that you get like a credit card. You get a cast credit shot.
Yeah.
And it's all of the cast with a picture of them. And that's not something we see very often in films.
No.
At the start.
No, it's a really interesting start in general, because it is my first note is literally exposition for days, because it the character building is to the nth degree in this opening sequence. It literally introduces everybody.
And it's just an interesting way of doing it with all these phone calls that they're all making,
which they bounce back to at the end of the film.
Yeah, and it's sort of bookended as well by the doctor with a scarred face.
Yeah.
The war veteran, where he says, after those first bits are played out, we got our introduction, because he says that nothing ever happens there.
Yeah.
He sort of bookends with. And like I say, it's a nice way sort of jumping into who these people are and the stories that we're going to get. And I don't recall ever really seeing an opening like that in anything else.
No. No, and in some ways, it's great that they've done something else, but it's incredibly slow going.
Yeah, yeah.
To get into the bulk of the film.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because we're finding out that the porter's wife is pregnant, that somebody's here to try and steal something, that somebody's there to sort of look after their diva star. And, all right, let's meet these people that you're talking about as well. And it's
Yeah, very much so.
I did know as well early on. The always nice to see a Daft Punk on screen as well. They're always cute.
Yeah,
that dog was cute.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a son that desperately wants a sausage dog.
Hi.
but I'm fighting him because I want a bigger dog. If we're gonna get one, but no, that's a family favourite is a dachshund.
Yeah, I had a relative had one of those. He could be a right handful, but he was so damn cute. So, right. So we're jumping back in here, and talking about the disfigurement. I thought that was one hell of a disfigurement makeup that they used.
Yeah. It's very reminiscent of kind of what they used for Two-Face. And
yeah,
considering it's 90 years difference, there's definitely some similarities.
Yeah, he wouldn't have looked out of place in like the Batman serial from way back in the day.
Yeah,
that makeup. there was something here that I sort of don't note down about the fact that how many of them seem to be kind of living in the hotel. They're there for not just like for an overnight.
Yeah,
they're like staying in the hotel long term.
Yeah, definitely. It kind of sets that up, doesn't it, at the beginning.
Yeah.
With the guy in the
suggestion that he's staying there long term, and also I can't remember the chap's name with the glasses, the accountant, who says he wants to live there. What's a crab line? Is it something like that?
Yeah,
Kringle line. That's it. Kringle line. Yeah,
yeah. Who's in the presidential suite?
Yeah,
on the top floor.
Wangled his way into there with a bit of bluff. Because I had visions that he wasn't going to pay for it at the end. He was going to like do a dine and dash.
Yeah,
that's what he was planning to do. But it turns out, of course, he has a way of winning money. Something I picked, which is nothing like I've ever seen in a hotel, is when they get up, all these various characters get up to that floor that they're staying on. There's like a help desk.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Oh. That there's a receptionist on every floor.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So that's just a pretty novel idea, actually. You just go out, wander to the end of the vault to sort of sort out your problems.
Yeah, and they put phone calls through, so it'd go to them first. So the main help desk would pick it up, pass it to the receptionist, who would then pass it on to the room.
Yeah. That's so different to when my key cards don't work at the Metropole and I have to go back downstairs to get it recharged.
Yeah, at least that's in the same building.
Yeah.
I've been to hotels where they've been separate buildings and the card has stopped working and you have to go all the way over to the other building.
The Thistle was a bit like that, wasn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. Especially when you were in that far wing that was opposite, that was by the... So for anybody that doesn't know, we're talking about the Thistle Hotel at the Heathrow Airport that we've been staying in for, it's over 20 years now.
Yeah, we did a few conventions there.
And they had a block of, it was family rooms, wasn't it, really? Or they cast them as suites, but they were family rooms. They were in a completely separate building to everything else.
So if it did go tits up, you had to go all the way out, across the car park. Give me a desk in the hallway any day of the week.
definitely.
Yeah. But we get some more character stuff then, and we can see early on that I'd written down here that the Baron who we're introduced to sort of seemed just as dodgy as Cripple Line.
Yeah.
And dodgy characters seem to be throughout this film. The support staff for the dancer, played by Garbo, they're not great people, as we discover towards the end of the film as well.
No.
They're supposedly looking out for her, but they're only really looking after their own interests.
Yeah. I agree with you. It's a very strange cast of characters.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can tell it's got its basis in a novel, can't you? There's that novel feel.
It feels like things like Clue and stuff like that. Like, there's very much a feeling of that, and obviously Poirot stuff like that.
Interesting, I'd written down whilst I was watching this. I don't know whether you've ever seen the episode, but there's an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation called The Royale.
Yeah.
Where they then go to this planet, which is just, it's basically they develop for this astronaut this sort of this living accommodation, which was basically based on a novel he got with him about a hotel. And it just felt, it's very much in that same vein of these people coming through the main doors, and we just get introduced to a little bit of their life.
Yeah, yeah, very much. It's
oddness in the background.
Yeah, it's a very oddly put together film. Because the first half kind of spends all that time setting up. We'll say it now because we haven't actually said it. The Baron is the thief.
Yeah.
And it spends so much time setting that up.
Yes.
that you're already halfway through the film, and by that point, the second half of the story suffers because of that.
Mm.
It's very strange that they build him up as kind of this posh character, and actually it's all a cover.
He's got no money. He's squandered it all on gambling. And he's basically doing it as if you're trying to get out of a gambling debt, isn't he? I think. But you never quite know who he's going to joke with. But then, of course, we see this weird sort of bit later on in the back end of the film where he sort of has a change of heart, where he's basically there to steal the. And it's just, he's there to steal a string of pearls. How much are they worth?
Yeah, there's some really strange moments with his character as well. Early on, when we first kind of find out, and he goes through that first kind of theft, and he's hiding in the room.
Mm.
And she discovers it. Well, she discovers him because she's trying to top herself.
Yeah.
And he can't kind of watch it and kind of outs himself as to what he is.
Yeah.
Very, very strange romantic moment.
Mm.
It becomes that it's just very, very bizarre that she goes from being on the verge of not wanting to be around
to suddenly having a guy that she can spend her life with. You know, for 5 minutes, and similarly, sort of, he's instantly smitten when he sees her trying to kill herself.
Yeah, yeah, it's all very weird. Twist.
You kind of wonder initially whether he's going to have some sort of interaction in relation with Miss Phlegm.
Yeah.
With Joan Crawford's character.
Yeah, which they still keep continuing throughout the film.
Mm.
There's still always that notion that there's possibly something there.
Yeah. And a lot of that is down to Crawford. Crawford, actually, I thought is the best thing in this film for me by far.
Yeah, very much so. She kind of... carries the film at times because she brings the characters together, doesn't she?
Yeah, and she's got this wonderful, cheeky sort of playfulness to the performance, and she looks so good in it as well. I never appreciated how attractive she was as a young actress. But she looks incredible in this film, and she's just so playful.
I think we're so used to seeing the older Joan Crawford. The older in the same kind of way as Elizabeth Taylor, of kind of Cleopatra, you don't see that younger version of her, and they're both very similar.
Yeah, a lot of those films don't really turn up on the box very often. You forget what they were like when they started out in somebody's career. Yeah. But it's just such a wonderful turn. She almost feels like she's going to look to the camera and wink and break the fourth wall on a couple of occasions, because it's just that sort of really sparked performance.
Certainly that opening scene of them on the balcony when he first meets her. There's something very, as you say, breaking the fourth wall type looks.
Yeah.
Not quite at the camera, but...
Yeah.
Because they don't look at each other in that scene.
No. Going back to the nomination, and I would argue that she was probably worthy of a, from what I've seen of this, of a supporting actor nod, an actress nod.
Yeah.
It is that sort of performance that in the modern era, you would get that they get a Golden Globe nomination in the comedy musical section.
Yeah. Definitely.
One of those performances. So I was surprised that she didn't get a nomination actually for it. There's one thing I did write about this hotel is so dreary. It needs a convention.
It needs us in the bar.
Yeah. Another quirky thing I picked out of that is when did the Baron become Spider-Man?
And did it without being seen.
Yeah. 1 minute he's this shifty cigarette smoking dude. Next minute he's climbing up the walls of the hotel to nick a bunch of pearls. I thought, where did that come from? Why is that bloke got no money when he's got mad skills like climbing the side of a building?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, his was an interesting character throughout the film, I thought. And that end for him when it comes is actually really shocking.
Yeah, it really is. You don't expect. And he is the lead character.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's the one you stick with throughout the film.
Yeah,
and for him to get killed off 15, 20 minutes before the end.
Yeah. He is our main way into the film, really, isn't he?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he has that set to with the managing director at the end of the film when he tries to sort of steal his wallet. And the reaction of that guy is just incredible. And he just, holy shit, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Because the tone of the film doesn't indicate that that's going to happen at all.
Yeah. It's very, very strange. And as you say, then it kind of bookends with what we saw at the start.
Mm-hmm. Doctor saying that nothing ever happens, when the fact that we've seen a murder, we come robbery, and we've seen a drunken man, dying man, confront his boss in the hotel bar. there's a lot goes on, which is kind of the point, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. A very strange end to the film. Yeah.
And then, of course, amongst all that, we've had the porter that we've come back to a couple of times, finds out that he's actually a father.
Yeah.
Sort of undercutting all that tension.
But makes you think that something else has happened with that call.
Yeah, initially, it's quite well done. And it's shot wonderfully from above as well.
Yeah.
I love the camera position on it. Because it's given us that sort of wide look over the reception area.
Yeah, and to see that life is still going on despite what's happened.
Yeah. And then we see other people noting his conversation and being able to congratulate him. So for me, it's a really interesting piece of work in terms of, it's like this series of vignettes that are just something we've come across before that are shoved together and shook up, and you come out with this interesting but not always entirely successful story.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's very much a film of two halves as well.
Mm.
Despite the fact, as you say, that there's kind of individual, we see individual bits of each story within those halves, but there is a very, very linear story throughout the two halves.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. The Baron story probably is the core story, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think. And then he sort of floats into the relationship story a little bit with the singer and touches on a sore story. And then he has that secondary relationship with Kringlein, and sort of being a friend to him. And then we see that weird stuff before he dies, of him going back to being a shit briefly. Oh, is he going to take all that money, that 14,000 marks? And then when the guy breaks down, of course, and says that it was the money he was going to spend in his last days, we see him sort of have a second crisis of conscience and turn it around.
Yeah.
Well, I think that just undersells how shocking his death is in the end. The bloke was kind of trying to find a new path for himself. And then all of a sudden, he's just completely snuffed out. What?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very odd way to finish the story off.
And then, of course, that there's a double whammy of that with Garbo's character, where none of her staff want to tell her what's happened.
Yeah.
And she's buggering off to the station expecting to turn up so they can go off to Paris, is it, I think, together.
Yeah.
And you think, you bastards, none of you are going to tell her.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some real harsh characters in this as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that mini-arc, mini-subplot is quite sad that she'll bugger up not knowing what happened to him.
Yeah.
When everybody else in that vicinity knew that he's dead. But then, of course, we get the way that the film sets it up, we get that sort of arrival. They all go, and then we get potentially a new set of stories.
Yeah.
With that couple in the fancy car, in the sports car, turn up.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that's when we get the doctor come back in with his sort of nothing ever happens in this hotel. And it pulls out quite nicely as well.
Yeah,
that sort of the Grand Hotel is sort of just as a background shot, and also over the credits, then sort of the names up there on the screen. So at that part, I don't know if you got anything else you want to add that you noted.
Not a huge amount, to be honest. As you say, it was. I found it quite difficult to make notes on this.
Yes. Yeah, particularly in the second half of the film, I find,
Yeah, mainly because as I said, they spend so much time in that opening half of the film kind of introducing everybody and setting up that kind of ending to the first portion, setting up what he's going to do and how it's going to be, that the second half doesn't flow in the same way. They try and pack so much in that second half. And this film's less than 2 hours long. And it does pack a lot in. And it isn't your typical 30s winner. We've talked about how they are very much kind of separate, normally 5 or 6 separate stories with the same characters. With the 1930s films. So you'd get something set right at the beginning and then there'd be an action sequence as such. A lot of these films this early on are kind of war movies and stuff like that. And there was a lot of those little separate stories. This one kind of has those separate stories, but they're all kind of revolving around that main storyline, which is very different than, as I say, a linear storyline throughout the two portions. Unfortunately, the story isn't always strong enough to carry that. And some of those portrayals aren't quite what they need to fill it out.
The killer, the managing director, that I thought that's Wallace Beery's character. We didn't really get much of a handle on it, and other than he's got a deal that fell through and now he's turned into a killer at the end.
Yeah, very much so. And that was kind of my problem. And when it did concentrate on that poor storyline, it worked. But it was those interchangeable bits around it that didn't always pull together. The second half is a rush. To get back to that storyline. And that was really all I had. I didn't really have a read on the characters for the most part. They were very changeable throughout, as you mentioned with the Baron. He flits between a lot of different versions of himself throughout the film. Just didn't get a grab on him.
So what kind of a score do you think you want to give this one?
To be fair, I still enjoyed it. It wasn't that it was bad. I'm going to give it a 77 because I still enjoyed watching it. I didn't think it was a bad film, especially for a 1930s film. Yeah. I think it tried really hard to be something different. To what we've already watched.
I kind of enjoyed it. I didn't think it was one of the strongest ones we've done. I got more out of it than I did out of American in Paris, surprisingly, when you think that James Kenney was in it. Score-wise, I scribbled down 75, so we weren't far out with it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Two films, one with very different scores and one with very similar scores. So you just don't know how it's...
Never know.
No,
it's always interesting doing the ones that neither of us watched before to see what we'll come out with out of them, as opposed to a rewatch for one of us. And talking of rewatches potentially and what we're going to do, I suppose we should have a look at what the next two we're going to be now at this point.
Yep. So these are very, very different eras.
Oh.
I don't think they could be any different. So the first one I pulled out was 2019.
I want to say Green Book.
And one that I think we've been waiting to come up for quite a while. 1931.
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yep.
This will be interesting because this is, I've seen the Netflix version. Interesting to compare those. Those are two very, very different films.
Yep. Very, very different ends of the Oscar spectrum.
And both first time watches, because I never saw Green Book when it came out.
Yep.
Both first time watches again.
Likewise for me.
Right, okay. Well, in that case, mate, thank you for that.
No worries.
And we will see you again next month, listeners. Thanks.